Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome back to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa and today the whole gang are here. Stephanie, Nicola, Linda, Pat and Heather.
Hello!
Hi!
We're massively excited to be back together, but we're going to hold back from hearing any more about Heather and Nicola's amazing trips till after we've finished recording. I will just say we're all wearing our beads from New Orleans. This week, we're exploring well-being for writers. I'll be talking to Helen Suddards about yoga for writers. Nicola will be sharing her work in progress and we'll be critiquing it. Heather and Angela King will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. And Rephany Stouse is going to talk about spoonerisms. But first, Linda will ask us to...
name the novel.
Yes, I will. But first, here's a shout out to a member of our Facebook group, Kevin Russell in Spain, who posted that he got last 2 weeks name the novel on the first clue.
Bravo, Kevin.
Let's see how you do with this one, Kevin. Thanks for posting. Clue one. This novel was published on 20 June 1890 in Lippincott's magazine as a novella of 13 chapters. Ooh. It was later revised and lengthened to 20 chapters and published as a full-length novel.
Okie doke.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking even Teresa could possibly have
gone. Not on that. No. It's narrowed it down, but not much.
I wonder if Kevin did. How are you doing there, Kevin? Did you? All right. Many reviewers thought the book was immoral. The controversy surrounding the novel caused W.H. Smith and Company to withdraw that month's edition of Lippincott's from its railway station bookstalls. Now?
Okay.
Teresa's looking smug.
Okay. I've got a thought.
Later, the author revised the story, cutting the most controversial passages that alluded to homosexual desire and references to female lovers. The book has a preface now that is famous in its own right for its defense of art for art's sake.
Got it.
Oh, I figured you'd get it.
I got it on the third clue.
Not the clue.
Because the second clue I thought, Jude the Obscure was very controversial, sort of late Victorian novel. But this, anybody else?
Anybody? No?
No, I was thinking the one that had the wrestling scene with Oliver Reed.
Oh, yeah.
That, but that's a bit later.
That's 20th century.
Yeah,
Women in Love.
That's the one.
No,
yeah.
This is The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde.
That's right, you're right.
Well, I didn't have a clue because I'd never heard of the magazine and I assumed it was American.
I was thinking it was an American.
So was I.
No, The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. Yeah. If you got it, please post and let us know if you did.
And the preface is, all art is useless. Mm.
Is that what it is? My gosh, look at you. You're so smart.
Well, that was a good one, Linda. Thanks. It kept us hanging till the end. And I'd be interested to know which clue Kevin got it on. So, Nicola, you've got something for us.
Yes, well, your writing for The Telegraph has inspired me. And I was thinking about, looking back on my trip to Sydney, which came before the other trip. And so I've written a bit about the nighttime there. Cities are varied things, each with a different personality to another, but one element stays the same, and that is the noise of the night. Cities never sleep, and neither, it seems, do many of their inhabitants. For most of my stay in Sydney, it is hot, nearly 32 degrees some nights, and that means either submitting to the roar of the portable air conditioning unit or opening the windows. So, 5 floors up, the windows are wide open. The harbour breeze cools me until the wind shifts in slightly the wrong direction, setting up a banshee howl between the bedroom at the back and the kitchen at the front. The chug of the ferries crisscross the harbour, taking Sydney folk home after a long day's work, or an even longer night's fun. Their engines a bass note, underscoring the thwack-thwack of the police helicopters hurrying to an emergency. The shriek of metal being cut to mend Australian Navy ships in the dry dock down the road pierces sleep like nails down a blackboard. That mingles with the beep, beep, beep of reversing lorries, shouts of fighting neighbours, and the urgent honk of taxi drivers trying to pick up a fare before Uber gets there. Croaking ibis are settling for the night in the trees over the splashing water dandelion of the Alamein fountain, fighting for space with squeaking giant fruit bats who thud the square below with their foul-smelling droppings. Both ignore the roar of traffic of Potts Point and King's Cross, perhaps relieved that the shouting and fighting of late-night revellers is now gone, moved on by the new laws limiting late-night drinking to the city centre areas only. Through the night, electrical storms crack the sky open with forked lightning, and the growl of thunder slaps and echoes around the bay. As the night wears on, even Sydney breathes more slowly and settles into an uneasy sleep for a few merciful hours before the sun peeps above the skyscrapers again, the rising heat lifting the water from the harbour in a silent, haunting, damp mist. As the blurred watercolour majesty of the Sydney dawn sky intensifies, the first ferry appears, leaving a frothy, foaming wake across the harbour on the way to Manly Beach. As it slowly gets light, I wake up, slowly, listening to the tap, tap, tap of the blind against the window frame where the early morning breeze has come to play.
You use the most wonderful action verbs in this. I've marked so many of them. You have how the thunder slaps and the electrical storms crack the sky open and the sun peeps and the dawn sky intensifies and
the banshee howls.
Yeah, and the
roar of the Potts Point.
Right, and this mingles with the beep, beep, beep. I love them. You do that so well. Mm. I'm always looking for action verbs for mine, but I sit there and say, what?
Well, it was much improved by your critique when we read it at Write Club Classic. So I took everyone's advice to heart. Mm. And I think it's a better piece for it, apart from the two slowlies in the last paragraph.
Yeah, you notice when you read it out loud.
Yeah. And also you've got three fightings. You've got fighting neighbours, fighting for space, and fighting of late night revellers in adjacent paragraphs, but that's easy to solve.
And three asses.
Three what? Three
asses.
Asses.
Pat's highlighting.
You can see how desperate we are. I think it's excellent, original, evocative. Mm. I love the focus on one sense of sound, although you do bring in others, but it's mainly about the sound. I love the way it is a moment in time. It is a particular place. It's definitely Sydney. We know that from the references to the location. And it's just great. And I was glad that you ended with the sound of the blind flapping the window frame, because I thought maybe you were going to end with a visual image, but you brought it back to sound.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
It was so noisy, I had to wear my headphones to sleep some nights. Yeah.
There is one place in the second paragraph when you say, I love the way you say it is hot, nearly 32 degrees, because that brings us into the immediacy.
Yeah.
But then you say that means either submitting to the roar or opening the windows. If you change that to, that means either I submit to the roar or open the windows. So you take the in words out. Okay. I think that would make it a little bit more active. But as you see, I am struggling here to find things to help you make improvements. Yeah. I've marked a few, I think silent, haunting, damp mist. I think silent, haunting mist is enough, because I think mist is by its very... Mm. Well, mist is damp anyway, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think mist says damp. Yeah. But again, it's a fairly minor...
I've got one.
Minor thing.
The chug of the ferry's crisscross. Right. Now, I thought either the chug crisscrosses, because it's the chug you're referring to. No?
The
ferries crisscross.
The ferries crisscross, right.
Or the ferries chug across.
Right, that's what I'm right.
But the chug doesn't crisscross.
No. How can a chug crisscross? It's a sound.
Yeah, I suppose. But sounds travel.
Sound travels.
No, but that's what I thought. Either the ferries crisscross or the chug crisscrosses.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was my contribution. Yeah.
And I was going to ask Pat, the long day's work or an even longer night's fun.
Apostrophes.
Yeah. But I would have said after a long day's work or an even longer night of fun.
Mm.
Because then you don't have two apostrophe S's in the same sentence. Yeah. But again...
And I noticed when I read it that the blurred watercolour majesty was being observed by nobody because I was still asleep. Did you get that, Heather?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things of commas and apostrophes.
Can wake up, because that's such a beautiful line.
It is.
Get up earlier.
You need to wake up to the tap, 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 and then cross. Yeah.
See
the blurred watercolour
majesty.
Yeah.
It's a lovely line.
It is. Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, apart from the chug of the fairies, which I commented on, another suggestion on that following paragraph, the shriek of metal being cut to mend Australian Navy ships in the dry dock down the road, I don't think you need down the road, pierces sleep like nails down a blackboard.
Yeah.
I just felt that the like nails down a blackboard, which is you are comparing the shriek of metal, I thought they were too far apart.
Yes, I've made a note of that. Is there a better analogy than nails down a blackboard?
Or you just change the order and put like nails down a blackboard, the shriek of metal being
That works. No, I think it's a good analogy. Sorry to come back. Okay. But I think it's a good analogy, but it's just...
Yeah,
that's a good suggestion.
And I wasn't sure about that mingles. I thought either just it or...
Okay.
Comma and mingling. Mm.
Well, I think all these will make it better. So,
Don't
spend too much time on it. Get it in.
It's lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good.
Just one more thing. I was a little concerned. I wasn't sure about the tense in the beginning, but I know it's present tense all the way through, isn't it? It's just that I was thinking about.
It felt
just
a bit uncertain, didn't it, at the beginning?
I thought a little bit somehow, but I marked that. Don't pay attention to it anyway.
We'll edit that bit out then.
And also, each with a different personality to another. I thought another is redundant because different.
Thank you. Yeah, I felt that wasn't quite right.
And there's a lot of good marks on there.
Great stuff.
Yeah, well, I knew we wouldn't get away without talking about her trip.
We've got Vegas to come next.
I know. You're going to do a just back for that.
Brilliant. Great stuff. So, Stephanie, what have you got for us today?
Well, I wanted to talk about spoonerisms. A spoonerism, as you said when you called me Refany Stouse, is a verbal error in which a speaker transposes the initial sounds or letters of two or more words, and it's often humorous, as in, I think you probably remember the two Ronnies of British TV programme where he talked about raising a glass to the queer old Dean.
There's a chap, and I can't remember his name, that did a whole thing about Cinderella.
Yeah.
Rinderseller,
yeah.
Yes, and I can't remember his name, but he did it completely from start to finish.
Right.
It was just amazing.
Yeah, I've heard that. I remember. Find him, but I don't remember his name. These slips of the tongue were named spoonerisms after a British clergyman called William Archibald Spooner, and he was very nervous. He was an albino, actually. I'm not sure if that had anything to do with his speech impediment, but he frequently stammered and he got tangled up. He would say things like a blushing crow when he meant a crushing blow. And I remember once my husband fell out of bed and said, "Oh my God, I feel like a humpled creep." So they can be good. And apparently William Spooner addressed a group of farmers as "you noble tons of soil," instead of "you noble sons of toil," which is fabulous, isn't it? So he also apparently at a wedding said, "It is customary to cuss the bride." "The Lord is a shoving leopard instead of a loving shepherd." "A well-boiled icicle instead of a well-oiled bicycle." I mean, there were so... And he once said to a student, "You've tasted two worms," when he meant you've wasted two terms. There's an awful lot of ways to use spoonerisms and wave the sails instead of save the whales. You have very mad banners. So there's lots of good stuff. One I particularly liked was "the weight of rages will press hard upon the employer" instead of "the rate of wages." Anyway, he's not the only person that did spoonerism. In fact, Harry Von Zell was a radio announcer. You might know about him, Linda. And he was part of a birthday tribute to Herbert Hoover. So he accidentally referred to the president as Hubert Hoover instead of Herbert Hoover. But according to Wikipedia, technically that's not a spoonerism. That is knifeerism.
A knifeerism? Ah.
Because it reverses the middle syllables of the word instead of the beginning sounds. Huh. So in a knifeerism, the nuclei of the words gets changed around. So hypodemic nurdle would be a knifeerism. And there's also, apparently, again according to Wikipedia, there's such a thing as a forkerism.
Wow.
And that is where the end of the word gets switched around. Ah. So all the world was thrilled by the marriage of the Duck and Duchess of Windsor. So there you go, go figure. So spoonerisms, knifeerisms and forkerisms. I thought you'd enjoy
brilliant.
That.
Brilliant. Well, that's... never heard of knifeerisms ever.
Nor have I.
That's great.
But well, you know... don't pet the sweaty things.
Why not?
How old do you think I am? Herbert Hoover? I wasn't alive.
No. I'm talking about it's a well-known...
The radio.
In radio land, it's a well-known mistake that somebody made. And I know that you were in radio for a little while.
Yes, I was.
You may have
heard about
poor old Zell.
What not to do in radio.
Thanks, Stephanie. Today, we're talking about well-being for writers. So there are lots of issues about that. There's physical well-being, there's the psychological well-being, being alone, things like that. So, Linda, what sort of things do you think are important to focus on?
Well, you know, what I have a great problem with is guilt, writer's guilt.
Oh, yeah.
And when I was researching this, I didn't realize it, but writer's guilt is a really, you know, common phrase. It's writer's guilt is a thing by itself.
Yeah.
I don't have guilt about writing. I have guilt about not writing. I got some good ideas from Isabel Costello from Life Writing. And she says, writer's guilt and why I don't recommend it. And I thought, she's very right, isn't she? But she says she spotted some advice which concluded with an emphatic, write every day, you know. And that, she says, I don't think it was someone I follow, and it's nothing we haven't all seen a million times before, but something about the tone got on my nerves. Mm. So I took to Twitter saying, the least helpful writing tip ever is the bossy, write every day. I'm a big believer in thinking time and downtime.
Yeah, and also that is where the guilt, comes from. When you have a day and you've got to the end of the day and you think, I haven't written anything, I haven't progressed anything.
Right.
And
happens to me a lot.
Yeah, and, and I think because it's not like, you know, a job where somebody, you know, it's structured and you have to do it. And it impacts on your self-esteem, doesn't it?
It does, because
then you feel worthless and rubbish.
Mm-hmm. Right. And most people have lives. Many of us still have children at home and husbands who might want some attention in the evening or whatever. It depends on an individual's situation whether or not they can write every day. And it's very damaging to put that kind of guilt on someone for not doing it. It's demoralizing.
Mm-hmm.
Guilt is very destructive. Don't feel it.
Yeah.
But we move our work along when we're daydreaming, you know, jotting ideas down as we're, you know, on a receipt or whatever, you're still doing it. You have to have time to think.
Mm-hmm.
The advice, think before you speak, is good. And so think before you write is also good.
Yeah.
You can't just, I mean, you are writing when you're moving in line.
And also when you're just experiencing things, as in the piece that Nicholas just shared with us.
Yes.
You have to be open to experience and you have to be living, just thinking about writing all the time and let it happen.
And I think it's important to remember, just take this away, writing is not the same as typing.
Wise words indeed.
Indeed.
Well, I have a problem in that I write a lot in my work and I sit at a computer a lot in my work. And actually, I can't believe I've actually chosen a hobby that I love so much, but which involves sitting at the computer.
Yeah.
So it is a problem for me, especially as I do get numb legs, swollen ankles, and you're supposed to get up and walk around. My Fitbit does remind me now, my new Fitbit, to get up every hour and walk a bit, which is quite good.
Or as Helen recommends in the interview, she said, just set an alarm on your computer. You don't need a special piece of equipment, that's great, but you don't need it.
I found something from the Mayo Clinic, which is an American clinic, and they say staring at the screen for hours can also lead to eye strain and fatigue. Right. Mm-hmm. And you should follow a 20-20-20 rule, which is every 20 minutes you take a 20-second break to look at an object at least 20 feet away.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So that will help with eye strain.
Mm-hmm. And it also keeps you awake if you're doing it late at night looking at the screen.
But we're not supposed to be awake late at night, are we?
Well, I write late at night.
But again, it doesn't help your insomnia if you're looking at a screen.
Blue screen.
People say 2 hours before bed, switch off everything.
I met the man in Vegas who sells these orange sunglasses that everyone's wearing, which cuts off the blue glare from your screen, apparently. Wow. So that's why they're selling so well.
Oh, good.
Right. Sorry, I'm just laughing because she managed to get Vegas in.
She has too much fun, folks. But what about your legs? You found a solution for?
Well, no, I haven't. Really, I try and occasionally write on the sofa. You know, I try and not write at the desk, but I find I'm just
writing on the sofa. I had a vision of you writing all over.
I think that's worse. I always sit at a table.
Yeah, it's bad for your back, isn't it? It's bad for your back.
But anyway, when we get to the interview with Helen, she's got tips on eye strain and other things.
Yeah. If you're in the flow. You just want to keep going, don't you?
Yeah, right.
Stop, no matter how much your legs just gone to sleep or whatever.
Maybe you should. You know, when you get. They talk about long flights, which you should know all about, of course. to avoid DVTs and things like that, they tell you to sort of like do a little foot exercise.
Yeah, cool. People just wear DVT, anti-DVT stockings. When you're sitting at your desk, that would be attractive.
That's a wrangle to get those on and off every day, won't it? Well, I did use your plastic bag tip.
Oh, right.
Yes, which worked.
What's the plastic?
Tell us. Well, you put a plastic bag over your foot before you put the DVT stockings on, and they go on much easier, don't they? And then you pull them out the hole.
Yeah, your foot slides into it because there's a hole at the top. Pull the plastic bag out afterwards.
Works a trick.
When I have my knee replaced.
Smart people around, aren't they? That's genius.
But what about a standing desk? A lot of writers have used standing desks.
I tried that as well. I mean, I find standing just as uncomfortable as sitting. I mean, at my ex-husband's, the chairs are really uncomfortable. Legs go to sleep seconds. I stand up, I'm really uncomfortable, so I have to put a stool on the table to put the computer on top of. So I'm trying all the different combinations.
I've got an elevated thing. It's actually a bed desk you can adjust to sit in bed and work, because I quite like doing that sometimes, but I have it on my desk so I can actually stand up type at it.
So you can go between the two, sitting and standing.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, some people say, well, instead of if you've got a breakfast bar, don't buy a standing desk. You can use that, or you can improvise something if you've got a suitable shelf in your house. Yeah. And
you can get it like a seat where you're sort of perching rather than tilting your pelvis forward. Yes.
Sit on one of those great rubber balls you sit on.
We
used to do that for a while. But one other thing you were talking about how you have it up and your hands are going up when you do that. And one thing I was reading about, I read about carpal tunnel because I had that one time, and it says that it's not good to put your hands up, make the keyboard go a little bit down, and then your wrists are not going to be.
And you can get a support for your wrist as well.
Yeah.
You've got to find the way that's comfortable for you, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah. Everybody's different.
I found something on mybookeditors.com which gave just simple advice, and it was give yourself grace as a writer. Every writer I know is hard on themselves, and that includes the author of this. Stop caring what other people think. Take frequent breaks. Read just to read. Stay on schedule. Choose healthy eating habits. Get your exercise. Find thoughts. There's only one you, and we need you. Take care of yourself so that you can live a healthy and productive life.
Very good.
And it seemed really simple, but just do that.
It's more than that. I mean, I found I've quoted this before, but in 2014, Stanford researchers did a study on walking and creativity, because Steve Jobs was known for his walking meetings. He used to walk around while they were having meetings. Right. And Mark Zuckerberg, apparently, who's Facebook's chief exec, he's somebody that has meetings on foot. And apparently, a lot of people will pace back and forth when they're thinking. It comes up ideas. Yeah. So anyway, Harvard did this study, and they had people walking on treadmills facing a blank wall.
people walking outside in the fresh air, and people in wheelchairs moving through the same landscape. So people sitting. And they then did exercises to gauge creative thinking, right? So it wasn't about the movement of the landscape past the people in the walking, because they replicated that with the people in the wheelchairs. The overwhelming majority of people in these three experiments were more creative while walking than sitting. The creative output increased by about 60% when the person was walking, and 100% of those who walked outside rather than inside were able to generate at least one high quality novel analogy, compared to 50% of those seated inside. So, and then they did an insight and focus thinking test. So there's the creative thinking test and insight and focus thinking. And in that test, people who were walking performed mildly worse than those who were sitting. So the message is, when you're actually focused and getting the words down on paper, yes, you sit down and concentrate. But if you've got any kind of creative problem, go out and have a walk. And I've said that many, many times, that, you know, when I'm out walking the dog, I sit at my desk and I'm struggling with something. Go out and walk the dog.
Comes into my head. It's something to do with the amygdala and the eye line at the horizon,
I think, and the movement of the spine. There's lots of research being done to it. Go out for a walk, or go to the gym, or
if you're feeling frustrated. But also it just does you good in every possible way. And again, there've been, you know, research showing if you do, you know, walking on a treadmill in the gym compared to walking in the park, for example, that people who've been walking outside feel refreshed and people who've been in the gym feel knackered. But you're doing the same thing in effect, but because you're doing it as an exercise in a kind of artificial way, somehow you feel exhausted by it. So that's, and
that might help with your swollen ankles as well.
Yeah, it might do,
But it does interrupt your work quite significantly. Yeah. You have to be at a place where you can get out.
I think I've just accepted that I can't work on my book when I've been working on my other stuff. I have to have segregated days where I just sit down at the computer and work on my book and not try and do it after other things. I need to prioritise it.
Going back to what Heather was saying about, she mentioned healthy eating. I mean, so one of my images of, you know, the classic author is, you know, that with the coffee cup and the cigarette,
whiskey over
the bourbon.
I don't even like whiskey.
No, bourbon, because it's always American.
I think there are kind of there are two ways you can go. One is you sit there all day and you forget to eat, and perhaps get by on coffee or cigarettes. And the other is the snacking and the bad
chocolate
nutrition.
Lots of biscuits, lots of chocolate. So I came up with, you know, just some suggestions, because if you either you're time limited or you're sort of really focused and don't want to have to get up and think about food and drinks and so on. Just plenty of water, and you need protein. Hummus.
Hummus
is the writer's friend, I think, because, you know, it's not heavy, but there's loads of protein in there. It keeps you going. Get some little veggies, get some cucumbers, carrot sticks, whatever, and stick them in your hummus. And nuts. Almonds, apparently, are supposed to be really good for you. And this sort of stuff isn't going to sort of pile the weight on, because that's the other danger, isn't it, that you're sitting there all day, you're not getting the exercise, you're snacking on unhealthy stuff, and you'll put weight on. And fruit, loads of fruit. And get some natural yogurt and add a load of fruit and muesli to bulk it up a little bit, and it keeps you going.
All sorts of stuff like that. And you can eat it with one hand while you're typing with your other finger.
You'll end up with a very messy desk, but it doesn't matter.
Great ideas there.
Or you need a Roy that comes home with me. And feeds me.
We all need a Roy.
And if you're wondering what a Roy is, it's Heather's husband.
He feeds all of us on many occasions.
For new listeners.
One of the things I was going to add is just, you need to cut down on the alcohol and be sure and get your 5 a day. That's, you know,
you've gone too far now.
But cut down.
we're all looking at her aghast.
Not the 5 a day.
In my previous life, one of my responsibilities was for an HR function within the business that I worked in. And we were looking at people working remotely or at home on their own.
lots and lots of companies now have people working from home, working remotely. And one of the things that we looked at, it was twofold really. It was about the risks to mental health of people working in isolation, because, you know, we are pack animals, we do need human interaction. And it can be bad for your mental health to go days without speaking to anybody else. And speaking to customers on the phone, or, you know, doing problem solving if you're, say, on a help desk or a service desk, isn't the same as having human interaction, because you're very much in the subordinate service role. So we looked at that, and we also looked at being able to leave your desk and leave your work behind, because there is something about walking out of the office and sort of shrugging off all the responsibilities of the day. And what we were concerned about was how people would feel if their home had become their working space. Now, I mean, I'm talking a few years ago now. Everybody now carries a device with them, and people are at work when they're on holiday and they wake up in the middle of the night and do emails
on the train
and so on.
And
but we looked at all that, and I think it's really important to remember that as writers, that while writing is an outlet that can help us verbalise emotions and feelings, sometimes we do actually need to speak to people. So the cliche of the hermit up in his turret, smoking cigarettes and drinking bourbon and coffee and being grumpy and unwashed, is, you know, it's a cliche, but it can happen. Like you say, you can go days and you get really into something, and you know, you
isolation can be an issue, and we're very lucky that we have each other, but not everybody has a support group like this.
Exactly.
I go to the cafe about 4 o'clock in the afternoon just because I want to see humans around and talk to people. And then I, you know, on the days I don't do that, or I'm staying in for some reason, I make a little ritual of finishing, closing my laptop, clearing my desk, going and cooking something, and then I go to the living area. So so I have
and
a break.
And that's another thing that this study looked at, was what we called at the time defensible workspace. Now, we were looking at having people's desks in cupboards, which were twofold. One is so the kids couldn't scribble all over all their manuals or play with their computer or what have you. But, of course, these days, homes are smaller. People tend to work at their kitchen table or on their breakfast bar. Or, you know, not a lot of people don't have the luxury of a separate working space. And I have, the desk I have now to work in is literally one tiny corner of a living room. But what I've got is a basket, which is about 2 feet wide by about a foot deep and or foot in depth. And then it's got handles at the side. It's just a little wicker basket. And when I've got loads of papers and everything, I pile them all into that basket and I push it under the desk and then push the chair in behind it. So my desk is then clear. Because I find if I leave my notebooks and stuff out, then I kind of cross the room to get a cup of tea in the evening, and all of a sudden I'm away and I'm doing it again, and I'm not taking the right sort of time.
Right.
The other thing is, obviously, my husband moans, but
that's his role.
Yeah, it's his job. Even in modern environments where we don't have a lot of space, I think if we are finding that
it's a psychological
space.
Yes,
it is. I'm going to put my work away now. I've finished now. I'm going to put it away. Like you say, you clear your desk.
But
I like to be able to get that basket out and then scatter everything around to me in the morning.
Well, I often write in pyjamas, so I'll just, you know, sit down and do it. But I know people that get dressed, that get ready to go, you know, and they will wear different clothes, and they've got like the business clothes on, if you like, and they sit down and they'll do that, and then at the end of it, get changed. And then put the pyjamas on. You know, and so they've got two distinct spaces.
There's lots of ways of doing it, aren't there?
One of the other things, you know, that writers may have issue with is rejection. Because, you know, as Stephanie said, she's aiming for 100 rejections.
Right.
But, you know, that can be quite soul-destroying, can't it? And the self-doubt that you have all the time. Because you're doing this thing, you're writing, you're trying to write something good, and you don't know if it has any worth at all in the world. So, you know, there are lots of psychological issues as well.
I think another way to relieve some guilt or not feel it in the first place is to stop reading about all those people who are really making great progress and having their first novels published and How I Did It, etc. and instead of that, just go and read some really great rejection letters.
And you gave us quite a few of those some months ago, didn't you? You gave us some great rejections.
What I've discovered interviewing all the people that we've interviewed is none of them did it overnight. Very few people write their first bestseller.
Yeah.
I think Asia Mackay was probably the one who struck lucky, but she put the work in.
She did it with four children.
She was up at 5 a.m. to work, you know, she made it happen. So you know, it may not have been 20 years of hard slog like poor old Nick Hornby, but J.K. Rowling or
Marina,
Gavinsky's.
I can never remember her name. Sorry, Marina Lemichka.
Tracks in the Ukraine.
Yes. Anyway,
I just say good for them. We're all individuals, and we all have our own ways of doing it. And just if you start to feel guilty, just think about what a gift you have to be writing in the first place, and do it in your own way, in your own time.
Brilliant. Well, thank you, Linda. So, a couple of days ago, I spoke to yoga teacher Helen Suddards about some of the benefits she believes yoga can bring to writers. Now, I thought I was going to interview her, and I ended up having my first ever yoga session. But it was great fun, and she was a delight to talk to. So today, I'm on the beautiful terrace of the home of Helen Suddards in the Mani in Greece, with a view of the Mediterranean Sea. And Helen is going to talk to us about yoga for writers. So, Helen, tell us a little bit about yourself.
My husband and I, George, have been living here for 17 years, and I've been teaching yoga here for 17 years at the Spirit of Life Yoga Centre near Ios Nikolaos. And I've been teaching yoga for about 21 years. It's my retirement profession. And practicing, it's a practice for life. I'm continuing to evolve my practice, and I enjoy sharing my journey with others. And really, I think yoga obviously has benefits for everybody. Not only does it have the power to keep our bodies strong and supple, but it also has positive effects on the brain, particularly increasing the grey matter in parts of the brain associated with attention, visualisation and stress regulation, which I think probably is useful for everybody, but maybe particularly for writers who are beset by criticism from other writers and from themselves, perhaps more than anyone else, and beleaguered by the ups and downs of the writing process. And yoga encourages us to observe our bodies, our thoughts and our habits with detachment and kindness towards ourselves more than anything, and can help us to be more objective and compassionate, not only to other people, but to ourselves and maybe editors of our own work, perhaps taking a more objective and compassionate
view. I think that, you know, self-care is a really important point, actually, because often, you know, you get absorbed in your work, and you're sitting there and you forget to eat, and you forget to wash and dress some days, you know. So I think that is, you know, it's all part of that self-care and avoiding self-neglect.
Mm-mm. Yeah, and I think anybody who's sitting for a long time is probably going to start developing problems with their hips, their lower back, their shoulders. We're all, when we're on the computer, we don't think about not hunching over, and possibly the neck and the wrists. And we all know that if we're working on the computer, we should get up every 45 minutes or so and walk around. But who does that? Even I don't do that. So I was thinking about some of the things that one could do if you're sitting for a long time in front of the computer, as a writer is. And I guess most people these days are using a computer, but even if you're writing by longhand, you're sitting hunched over a desk.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose one really important thing that you can do without actually disturbing your position in the chair is just to breathe and to notice your breath. And maybe just take a few moments to breathe in, count how long your in-breath is, and then breathe out and count how long the out-breath is. And then try to match the out-breath with the in-breath, or the in-breath with the out-breath, whichever is the longest.
Right.
So that's something that takes your attention, or, you know, takes your focus purely onto the breath, allows your mind to slow down, to clear itself. And I think when we practice that sort of mindful practice, you know, our minds can then return to the work with a slightly more clarity than they had before we took a short break. So that's something you could do, you know, in a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
But of course, that helps your mental relaxation. It gives your mind a break. But also maybe things of just getting up, setting a timer on the computer so that you get up at mm-hmm. 45 mm-hmm. minutes, maybe every hour, realistically. Mm-hmm. And just stand against a wall.
Right.
Stand in the pose of a mountain against the wall, you know, making the feet even on the ground and extending the legs and the spine and the crown of the head away, drawing the shoulders back towards the wall. That's a great, mountain pose is a great pose for adjusting the posture.
So when you say mountain pose, so your heels are not against the wall, or
the
are
heels
they?
Are against yeah, the wall. So you're putting your heels, okay. your bottom, your shoulders right. against the wall and the back of your head.
Okay.
And actually putting your spine and your body in the position that it should be, mm-hmm. but rarely is, whether we're sitting at a desk or not. So that's so you could actually just put a little timer on your computer yeah. that said, get up, do mountain pose.
Yeah.
Stand against the wall. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that's through all the sort of poses that I've, the ideas that I have for movement, which would be good for writers, I think one thing to bear in mind, I think it was Ernest Hemingway who said, don't confuse movement with action. So actually it's quite, if you're only going to do one thing,
mm-hmm.
it's important to do one thing meaningfully.
Right.
Rather than lots of things mindlessly.
Or in a rush or ticking them off rather than.
And if you only got a few minutes or if you only want to spend a few minutes mm-hmm. away from your screen or from your page, one pose is going to be a lot better than trying to rush through several poses actually getting more stressed mm-hmm. because you think, oh, well, I should have spent longer, I should have done more, better just to do one thing.
And then you get those feelings of low self-esteem because I've done it wrong or done it badly, which we're trying to avoid.
Yes. Apparently Jack Kerouac did headstands.
Oh, really?
He used to get him to do a headstand. But don't try this at home. if you've never done a headstand, I don't think you should start doing it now.
Yeah, not at my age. Not without doing something else first, building up to it.
Well, maybe even then. It's, The other thing you could do is just like twist in the chair.
Oh, yeah.
Right, just put, one hand behind you, one hand up maybe on the arm of the chair or mm-hmm. under an arm on the seat of the chair. Think about extending the spine upwards.
So just and to now, describe, Helen put one arm across her body and the other arm behind.
That's a good point. Yeah. This time your foundation, if you like, is your sit bones, your bottom, mm-hmm. and your thigh bones. So they're drawing down into the chair. You're extending your spine up and mm-hmm, away. Mm-hmm. I can see you're changing
I'm
your posture.
I'm doing it.
You're changing your posture already.
I'm very suggestible.
And then, so if you're twisting to the right, your left arm comes in front of your body, your right arm goes behind you, and you just extend the spine and turn. Turning from the base of the spine, so thinking about turning perhaps from your belly button,
mm-hmm.
Towards the, this isn't a great chest, towards the right, and then come back. And then do that the other way. And that actually is quite releasing for the spine,
yeah.
but also it is good for the hips as well. And that's something, again, you can do without actually getting out of the chair.
Yeah, brilliant.
And the other thing is that you're stopping to do that, and you're putting your mind into doing the twist
mm-hmm.
and taking it, giving it a rest, and giving your body some benefits as well. Other things you can do just sitting in the chair are rolling your wrists.
Right.
Or doing this sort of stop action with a stretching your hands, pushing away and bring them down. That sort of will help stretch out your hands and your fingers, which again, with holding the pen can mm-hmm. get quite tense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whilst doing mountain pose, actually, or even while sitting by the screen, you could do movements of the eyes.
Right.
And that's actually quite good because when you're using your eyes to focus on the page or the screen,
mm-hmm.
you can develop sort of a strain in the eyes, which mm-hmm. obviously can be a strain we see with our brains, really. The mm-hmm. eyes are just lenses. So just moving the eyes up and down.
Right.
And then side to side.
So keeping your head still and just...
And just moving the eyes up and down, side to side, with the eyes open to start with.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the eyes shut.
Right.
So do it a few times with the eyes open and then with the eyes shut. Possibly better not to be sitting in front of the screen when you do that, because then your eyes are still perhaps engaging with what's in front of you. So maybe when you're doing the mountain pose, standing up,
mm-hmm.
you do the eye movement, and that means you might stand in mountain pose for a little bit longer, get mm-hmm. more benefit from that,
mm-hmm.
but also get some exercise for the eyes. I always remember my father didn't do yoga, but my father, he used to read a lot about health and movement, and he was very into exercise and diet and stuff. And I can always remember he had this like board with a sort of drawn on the board, like a cross, two crosses. And he'd look at the board in front of his face and then just look up at the top of the cross, down to the bottom, and then across. So again, you could do that sitting down. You could draw it on the board, hold the board in front of the in front of the screen or the page, and do that. I'm not sure that it made any difference, but you certainly had very good eyesight up to the time that you died.
Well, they do say you can improve your eyesight with exercise if you stick at it. So.
Well, and I read somewhere that particularly for some of the things like more serious things that can happen to your eyes, like glaucoma and macular degeneration, these sort of exercises keep the... Because there are muscles that move your eyeball, keep the muscles that move your eyes toned and might have a positive effect. Another thing you can do sitting down is just interlace the fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Move the palms away from you, stretch your arms, drawing the shoulder blades back, and just move them towards a space above your head. They might not go there.
Mm-hmm. How far can you go? I mean, does it matter? Can you keep
going? It doesn't really matter. I think it's important to keep the arms lengthening rather than, lengthening, because you're stretching the arms, you're stretching the hands, you're employing the shoulders. A nice touch is to try and keep the shoulders drawing down towards the back so that your shoulders are not moving with the arms.
I am doing this, by the way.
And you're doing it very well. And then just bring them down. Change the interlace of the fingers and stretch them. So you're doing it the alien way.
Uh-huh.
And then bringing the palms up. And so you're pushing the palms open up towards the ceiling or to the sky, as we're sitting there. And drawing the arm bones down into the shoulder and the shoulders down away from the palms, from the wrists. Mm. And you can feel that in your shoulders.
I can, absolutely.
And that's a good way of stretching the hands, stretching the arms, and moving the shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I thought you can do sitting down is just give yourself a nice big hug.
So wide open and
tight. Yeah. And almost like you're trying to crawl the fingers towards together at the back, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's moving your shoulders in another way. So it's moving the shoulder blades towards the front, opening your back. And it's quite nice. I love myself. And then just do it the other way.
Crossing the other way, the other arm on top.
So I suppose one rule of movement is if you do it one side, always do it the other side.
Right.
Something else I thought you could do sitting down, which is good for your hips, is, I'll have to move back to show you this, is sitting with your ankle, one ankle, on just above the knee, so on the thigh, just above the knee. It's called like a figure four stretch. So often in yoga classes or in general fitness classes, people do this lying down on their backs.
Mm-hmm.
But doing it this way, so flex the top foot so that you're protecting the knee. And just hold on to place the hand gently on the, so you're, my right ankle is on just above my left knee, and my left hand is just gently placed on the left, on the right ankle. And then I can just push the right knee down a bit, and I can feel that in my hip. And it's just opening out the hip a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe when we do this on the floor, or you do it standing, you'll feel it a bit more in your butt, in your bottom, right cheek, I would say. And then put that one down. And as I said,
do the other one.
The most important tip here is to keep the ankle that is on the top of the on the thigh, to keep the foot flexed. So now I have my left ankle on my top of my right thigh. And
when you say flexed, you mean sort of up in effect.
Well, the toes drawing back towards the knee.
Yeah.
So now my left toes are drawing back towards my left knee.
Got that.
And then I just put my left hand on the inside of my left knee. My right hand is placed gently on my left ankle, and I'm just pushing that down a bit, and I can feel that in my...
Me too.
Yeah. So that's going to have... It might have a little bit of a stretch in your hamstrings as well.
Yeah.
And as an added benefit, you can think about lengthening the crown of the head up towards the ceiling or towards the sky in this case. So that's quite a nice thing you can do sitting down for the hips.
Yep. Yeah.
And again, you've taken your mind away for a short time. And it's allowed you to do something that's both physically beneficial but also a bit of a break for the mind. Another thing you can do against the wall, most people are familiar with downward facing dog. So I'm going to do this facing towards you.
Yeah.
So I've got my hands in that stop position.
Yeah.
And then I just walk away.
Right.
So that I'm lengthening the crown of the head towards the wall, the
palms are pressing into the wall. Again, lengthening the arms, so mm-hmm. I'm drawing the arm bones back into the shoulder sockets, and I'm lengthening my spine. That's a really nice, and you get length in the back of the knee. So most people, you know, if they've ever done a yoga class, will know downward facing dog, Ardha Mukha Shivanasana. That's Ardha Mukha Shivanasana, downward facing dog, against the wall.
Right.
And you're stretching the whole of the back of your body, lengthening the arms, also maybe getting some benefit to the to the hands and the wrists. A fun posture to do, but I don't suggest you do this with people, other people in the room, is lion's pose or lion's breath. It's called Simhasana, which is the Sanskrit word for lion. Mm-hmm. Asana is a posture pose. Mm-hmm. And Simha is lion in Sanskrit. And so I'll just demonstrate, but as I say, I wouldn't suggest you do this with... I can remember doing this when my kids were little, and they to this day, they remember me sitting and doing this pose.
So okay, they this is going to be funny.
So I place my palms on my knees, or the thighs just above the knees, and I extend my spine, and then I take a breath in. And as I breathe out, I'm going to stick my tongue out at you, Teresa.
Okay.
And I'm going to open my eyes really wide, so I'm going to go...
Brilliant.
And that allows you to... You do it 4 or 5 times. Mm-hmm. Again, takes you a minute, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It allows you to release and exhale, get rid of stagnant air in your lungs. Because sometimes we don't breathe... We breathe very shallowly, and actually that means that we don't actually release all of the air and the gases from our lungs and cleanse our lungs. So this is a way of releasing, and you have to engage your abdomen to force the breath out.
Right.
So there's a little bit of toning in the abdomen, and it also you're releasing this stagnant air, but maybe stagnant thoughts as well. And it creates some lightness of spirit, maybe. Yeah. It's funny. It also, energetically, in yoga we talk about chakras. And so there's a line of chakras following, basically following the spine, from the crown of the head to the anus, the perineum. And the throat chakra, which is the one here, is called Vishuddhi chakra. And it's associated with communication and self-expression. So this pose, lion pose, I'll demonstrate again. Is you know, should may help you to release a little bit more creativity, or if you're stuck.
Yeah, yeah.
Another thing that might be quite useful is to palm the eyes. Again, it's giving the eyes a break, and it may be allowing the thoughts to sort of settle down. So, just rubbing the hands vigorously together, so you start to feel some warmth. And then closing the eyes and putting the palms over the eyes.
Mm. I'll have to take my glasses off.
And it's quite calming.
So you're not putting any pressure on your eye?
No, you're just
over the eye.
Just over the eyes. The eyes are closed. And you're lying the eyes to have a rest.
Mm.
And maybe even your thoughts come a little bit more. Calm down and come a little bit more into a place of calmness and rest. So that's another thing you can do. Again, none of these things take more than a minute. The more of them you can do, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Something else you can do from the chair is a forward fold. Or again, people who are a bit more familiar with yoga might recognise it as Uttanasana. Usually we do this standing. But there's actually a whole sequences that you can do in the chair, which we tend to use for people who may not be able to stand for long, or, you know, so people who have some physical issues that mean they can't stand, they can't lie, but you can do yoga in the chair. And so with this one, you place the palms on the thighs just above the knee, lengthen the spine again, so this crown of the head is drawing up towards the sky. And you just slide the hands down the legs towards the feet, and you're folding at the hips, keeping the spine long. And then when you've gone as far as you can, because at some point the front of your body is going to meet the front of your thighs, and then you can just let the head, neck and shoulders go. So it's a seated forward bend, and then to come up, just lift the head and neck, lengthen the spine again, so now the crown of the head is roaring into the centre of the room, or towards your screen if you're sitting at your desk, and slide the hands
all the way back up.
And that's forward folds are very calming. So again, it's something that, you know, you can hang out there for a while, or you can just do it for a, you know, a count of four or five. And it the effect on your body and on your mind should be quite calming.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. Well, I've been doing all these exercises, or many of them, a lot along with Helen. So yes. I've had a little workout today. But honestly, I'm going to try and incorporate those into my daily routine because I think they're just really, really helpful.
Yeah, and I think perhaps the most important thing is to take breaks, is to stand up, is to do something different for a while. You know, the most important thing for your body, but also I think for your mind.
We
get stuck.
Yeah,
both physically and mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm trying to remember who it was now, but there was somebody who used to write standing up, but I can't remember who.
Yeah, and people now buy these standing desks, don't they?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's quite a popular thing now. But maybe that's
well. Beneficial. And I think the thing is when you my daughter actually has a standing desk, and I've tried using it when I've been staying with her, and I think when you because your body has to work to keep you standing, right? So there is actually a, you know, something going on the whole time. And I don't think you could use the standing desk and not move every 45 minutes or an hour. You know, you're standing for 45 minutes.
It's a long time. It is a long time.
The other thing I was reading about was this idea of if you're sitting, to have some constant movement going on.
Mm.
So maybe the hand that's not writing, you can just keep opening and closing that hand.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, when you're typing, just every few minutes or so, take the hands away and open and close the hands.
Yeah.
And another thing is perhaps maybe using a tennis ball and putting it under your foot.
Right.
And particularly if you suffer from bunions, if you put it, there are acupressure points on your feet that actually you can just roll, you know, I mean, you can be very specific about it, but just rolling the foot over the ball. So I'm doing this as I'm talking to you, just you can't see. But, you know, having a ball underneath my foot, maybe rolling the ball of my foot over the ball, putting the ball in the arch and rolling it there. And it just releases, I mean, it's like a mini reflexology session, you know. And you don't have to stop writing to do that.
True, true.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Helen. That's been absolutely brilliant. I feel quite inspired to do all those things. So thanks very much.
I wonder if that tennis ball would help with my numb legs.
I think it might. It couldn't do any harm, could it?
That is true.
I'll buy you a couple of tennis balls.
Oh, you have to do it 2 feet at once.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be able to concentrate on anything else.
What my wheelie chair as well? It all sounds quite dangerous.
But as I said in the interview, I am going to try and incorporate the stopping to breathe and the eye exercises. And also you mentioned an eye exercise, 20-20-20. So I think all those things that don't take up a lot of time and as well as, you know, giving you some physical benefit, you've got that psychological benefit of taking your mind away from what you're working on. So I thought there was some really helpful stuff in there.
Mm. Yeah, it's great interview. Mm.
Well, it's nearly time to wrap up for this week. But before we do, there's just time for Heather and Angela King to tell us what's on their bedside tables. Heather?
Well, I'm currently reading Knife Edge, which is the second of four books in the Noughts and Crosses series by Mallory Blackman. I read the first book some time ago, and although I'd seen the play, I was blown away by the story. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the Noughts and Crosses series.
Yeah.
The books use the setting of a fictional dystopia to explore racism.
Mm.
They depict a society where stereotypes are reversed. Won't say any more. Knife Edge continues the story of Seffi, but I'm not going to give anything else away because that's not fair. But you'll have to read it. Highly recommended. Mallory was the Children's Laureate from 2013 to 2015, and she writes primarily literature and television drama for children and young adults. And I think these books are aimed at young adults.
They are, yeah.
But they are wonderful for old adults as well.
Yeah.
I've been thoroughly engrossed in it. You know, and I'm looking forward to reading the rest.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you very much. Now let's hear from Angela.
Angela King, author of The Blood of Kings. What's on your bedside table?
At the moment, it's a book called Sisters to the King by Maria Perry, and it's the life of Henry VIII's sisters, which is fascinating. And Maria Perry, who wrote it, was a fashion editor. And so the actual concentration on costume is far and away better than any other book. And I've enjoyed her description of Henry VIII making sure his sisters wore the clothes that he liked. He was very fussy, apparently, that they dressed to his taste. Fascinating book.
Sadly, that's the end of Write Club the podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe on Radio Public, iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a 5-star review. Or drop by our Facebook group and introduce yourself. Keep sharing the love by introducing a friend to Write Club the podcast. Goodbye!
Bye! Bye.